so the topic today is American Indians, and specifically American Indian religion. And we're talking mainly now about North American Indians, although there are Indians, of course, right through Mexico and Central America and South America. Not so very long ago, maybe only 20 or 30,000 years, there was no inhabitants in the New World. American Indians came across first before the Eskimos. Those are the two main populations that came, American Indians. And there were several inflows of American Indians. They came across the Bering Straits when it was frozen over. And they moved all the way down gradually over the decades, over the centuries, until they filled up. And they spaced themselves out to give themselves berry picking grounds, clam grounds, hunting grounds, so on. Now, I live in Alaska, and actually, it's a lot bigger than it looks here. It's 1,000 miles by 1,000 miles, because I live in the center, and it's 500 miles from any coast. So, I've lived there for 16 years, and we have 10,000 Athabascan Indians, and we have 10,000 Tlingit Indians, who belong to the Northwest Coast culture group. Now, one interesting anomaly that no one has solved is that while we have 10,000 Athabascans here in Alaska, 10,000 across the border in Canada, and 120,000 in New Mexico. The Navajo and Apache are Athabascans, speak the Athabascan language. Now, how to explain that? See? They're 4,000 miles apart. I know, because I just drove 2,500 miles from Fairbanks to Portland. And it's another 1,000 miles on down south, or 1,500. Well, some people think they all came down to this area and some went back. And some think that they all came to Alaska and Canada and some moved on. And there's no answer yet, but they're studying the languages to see if they can find out. Yeah.
Can I ask a question, go back a little? Could you say then that the Indians that made this migration were of Mongolian extraction?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
All Indians and Eskimos came from Siberia and Mongolia. And we notice, yes.
Where do the Aleuts fit into it?
The Aleuts were part of the Eskimo family, and after they arrived over here, separated out into a different language and a different culture because of their isolation on the Aleut chain. That geographic distance caused cultural divergence. We notice similarities between American Indian shamanism, their magic rituals, their medicine men, and the Siberian shamanism, which is very big amongst the Siberian tribes, the nomadic Siberian reindeer herders and other tribes. We also notice the predominance of the flat, round drum in Siberia, flat round drum amongst American Indians and Eskimos. Perhaps it has a solar significance. You know, it's round and it has studs sticking out, pegs sticking out, rather like the sun. The American Indians astonished the early whites, the military, the priests, the explorers, with the elaborate funerary rites that they held. White men were astonished that so-called savages, who they just thought of as primitive people who scalped other people, would have such very beautiful and elaborate burial practices. As you know, they buried in huge mounds, especially here in the northeast, burial mounds. And they were buried with all of their needs for the happy hunting grounds, their tools, their weapons, their pots they would have to eat for the journey. In American Indian religion, there's no heaven and hell. There's a distant other world, sometimes translated as the underworld, but it's a distant other world attained in stages. I don't like to think of it as the underworld because that associates, you know, with Hades. It's another world that you dances and sing songs which part the undergrowth for you to make this journey through to the other world. and you have to propitiate these ancestor spirits on various stages. American Indians generally, of course, there's many different tribes, but to generalize across North America, Canada, and United States, there is one main creator. So you can almost think of it as monotheism, but there is a pantheon of spirits. There are the ancestor spirits of the forefathers. There are the haunting spirits of ancestor spirits who got lost and didn't make it, that stay around the village in the forest and haunt, and they account for disappearance of people. There are animal spirits, and there are the environment spirits, spirits of the mountains, spirits of the rivers. American Indian religion is not moralistic. They don't have their Ten Commandments or their Beatitudes. And it's not evangelistic. They war and they take prisoners, but they don't impose their religion. And their religion is very much bound up in music and dance and art. Music, dance, art, and religion are all one. Navajo sand paintings are religious. The different kinds of religion are animism, which means worship of animal spirits. They do a bear dance in the springtime where they mimic the bear clawing on the tree. And we notice the predominance of eagle feathers. The eagle soars. It's a noble bird. It's a white head and a white tail. And the eagle feathers are highly prized and are sacred objects. Matter of fact, the Department of the Interior only allows American Indians to have eagle feathers now. Another aspect of American Indian religion is totemism. A totem is an animal, a bird, or a fish that you adopt as the origin of your tribe, or it's the other way around. They adopt the tribe. And they have creation myths. American Indians have creation myths that explain their origin. Rather like our Genesis. Everybody in the world has a Genesis. The creation myths of the totemic people, the epitome of totemism is found here in the American Northwest. Among the Bellakula, the Kwakiutl, the Tsimshian, the Haida, the Tlingit, the Samish, all in this rich British Columbia area and the islands off the coast. There's 800 islands here in the Alaska Panhandle. Their totems are seen on the enormous totem poles, house fronts, canoes, other kinds of carvings like rattles and drums, and on the decorative beadwork on their costumes. With the Tlingit Indians of Alaska, a boy can look at a girl's costume and tell whether he can marry her or not, because half the tribe is eagles and half the tribe is ravens, and eagles must always marry ravens, and all ravens must marry eagles. And if she has a raven on her costume and you're an eagle, you better stop looking over there. But if you're an eagle and she's a raven, you could marry that girl. Well, that's called exogamy, marrying across a specific boundary. The shaman is the priest. He acts as an intermediary or a medium. He's also a healer. He knows how to communicate with the spirits, and often he does it with his drums and his song and his dance. Music is thought by many non-Western people to have supernatural power, and this enables you to communicate with the hunting spirits and the spirits of the other world. So the shaman's an important man. He's not as important as the chief. He serves the chief. Yes.
Question, are shamans and medicine men synonymous?
Same thing, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. They act as healers. So, whilst the American Indians have a religion, it's not compartmentalized like our religion, where we may be reading novels, but we go to the Bible for our religion. We may work Monday through Saturday, but we go to church on Sunday. It's all interwoven in their life. It's a shared belief system that explains life's meaning to American Indians. It explained why the whites came and destroyed them. And it adds purpose to life. and it provides some measure of control over destiny. As we know, they couldn't control the white coming. They can't control a tidal wave. They can't control an earthquake. But religion does provide hope, and you can pray that the tidal wave won't wipe out your village, or the earthquake won't burn down your village, and the whites won't come and kill all the women and children, and so on. Religion does provide... There hasn't been a culture found anywhere in the world without religion. And of course that depends how you define religion, but you, as long as you give it a broad definition of belief in the supernatural and belief in the hereafter, another world, all peoples have a religion. Religion also, for non-Western people, rationalizes failure. If the hunt is unsuccessful for a number of weeks or months, and the caribou herd doesn't come through or whatever, and the village starves, you rationalize that because the medicine men and the singers and dancers made a mistake in the dance, or they sang the words wrong, or they did it at the wrong time of day, or they omitted a certain taboo. Religious ceremonies amongst non-Western people are often very elaborate and full of minute, detailed ritual, which helps to explain failure when it happens. Religion also buffers death. If you believe that there is a happy hunting ground you're going to go to, then you have less fear of death as a warrior when you go into battle. Amongst certain American Indians, particularly the Inca in the Peruvian mountains and the Aztec in central Mexico, it sustained a power class of priests, very powerful, high caste of priests who ruled with a very authoritarian regime, and ordered temples to be built, and captured prisoners of war, and used them as slaves, and so on. Now, one important aspect of American Indian religion is the vision quest. That's a young man's initiation. He must go out into the mountains without food, and spend some time out there in the cold, in the mountains, exposure to the elements, perhaps suffers hypothermia, and he will have hallucination or vision, during which he will communicate with the spirits. They will come to him in voices or in dreams, and they will give him a song that will be his song for life, his manhood song. A specific form of the vision quest is found amongst the Plains Indians. It's called the Sun Dance. And they erect a pole, that magical link between the earth and the sky, and dance around the pole, which has ropes, fiber ropes with hooks on the end, copper hooks. And these copper hooks, they sink an inch or half an inch into the skin of their chest, and they hang and swing and sway and dance around the pole in pain and bleeding and staring at the sun, and they hallucinate, and that gives them the vision of their god and their initiation rite that helps them to pass into manhood. The sun dance then is a sort of trial of manhood by endurance. And, of course, American Indians are very brave and they don't cry out with pain. Not allowed to. This is called a rite of passage, where you leave an old state, in this case childhood, and you enter no man's land. And you emerge, after the ritual, with your status redefined. You have a new identity. You leave behind your old clothes, your old name. You become a man, and you are then reincorporated into the society in that new age set, or at that new level. During the history of the white occupation of North America, there's been certain culture clash reactions between American Indian religion and the coming of the whites. And this is called messianistic religions, where a messiah, much as the Jews hoped for a messiah to free them from the Romans, the Indians hoped for a messiah to free them from the whites, who stole their lands and killed their women and children. One example happened in 1871. It was the Ghost Dance. It originated in Southern California and spread through Oklahoma and Utah to Canada. And it was an Indian prophet who forecast that the whites would disappear if they danced, if all the Indians would dance this ghost dance. It's a kind of a hopeless, last-ditch tokenism to counter the feeling of helplessness, powerlessness, alienation, and enemy that they felt under the heel of the whites. Another religion that developed as a messianistic religion, as part of the culture clash between American Indians and whites, was the peyote cult. The peyote cult started amongst the Huichol Indians in Mexico. Bye, Michael. See you later. Take care of the money now in the snack bar. The Huichol Indians live in north central Mexico, and they take a vacation from their monotonous work in the fields once in a while to go on the peyote hunt, which is a small four-leafed cactus or mushroom that grows in the sand, and they call it the deer, and they shoot it at it with a bow and an arrow, and they stick the arrow in it and then pick it up and put it in a basket and chew on it. And it's a hallucinogenic plant drug, a poisonous alkaloid. And women and children take it too. The peyote cult spread into the American Indian Church, and it's now one of the few legal forms of drug taking in the United States, and they're talking now in Congress about banning it as part of the war against drugs. But in the American peyote cult, it's a formal part of the church service is chewing on the peyote cactus and having hallucinations and a vision of the fertility god, communicating with the spirits through an altered state of consciousness. This altered state of consciousness is brought about through several mechanisms. First of all, there's the hallucinogenic drug itself. It causes you to see violent colors and to hallucinate and to think that you're in a very highly colored world where time stands still. But there's also the drumming and the dancing. Now, energetic dancing over a prolonged period of time, such as American Indians do, produces certain biochemical and physiological changes in the body. Hyperventilation, increased blood glucose, no, decreased blood glucose as you use up the sugar, increased cerebral circulation, perspiration, increased heart rate, and then the drumming. Now, prolonged drumming interacts with the basic human brainwave rhythms. We have emanating around this part of the cortex the alpha waves, and they can be measured on an EEG, electroencephalogram. And they're between 8.5 and 13.5 cycles per second. And when you have drumming in this range, it interferes with or blocks the alpha rhythms of the basic human brainwave and brings about an altered state of consciousness, or it facilitates it. It lowers the threshold that the drug needs to produce the vision. So you have the complementary forces of the drug, the dancing, and the drumming. It's a kind of rhythmic, sonic driving, very hypnotic. And we find around the world, drums are always very important in rituals. You go to Africa or Borneo or anywhere in the world, and wherever they're having important religious rituals or initiations, they're using drums. Drums produce some direct effect on the brain. through their rhythmic interaction with the body rhythms. We're all full of rhythms. We have the rhythms of night and day and the heartbeat and the walking rhythm and the breathing rhythm, the pulse rhythm. And one of the reasons why music is so interesting is because the rhythms of the music interact with our own body rhythms. See, watch small children when you put on something rhythmic on the phonograph. See how they react. Later it gets blocked out of them. That's too primitive. You don't do that. We talked earlier about the elaborate nature of American Indian burial rites, funerary rites. There are various propitiatory stages where you have to placate the ancestor spirits, and you do this through various memorial potlatches and funerals. First of all, there is the burial. You must bury the body, and you open the window to let the spirit out. But the people that carry the casket and dress the body are rewarded at a memorial potlatch about a year or 2 years later, where, and this is very interesting, there are certain honored guests chosen to represent the deceased. Supposing four hunters died in a drowning on a big river. The four widows get together and all of their menfolk hunt and provide enough meat for a big potlatch. And then the food delicacies that the deceased enjoyed and preferred are taken to these honored guests in their home for 6 weeks prior to the memorial potlatch, as if they were the deceased. And the women folk, the widows and their sisters, make elaborate beaded work, moccasins, mittens, hats, dance tunics, a very valuable regalia, dance regalia, and these are intended as gifts to the honored guests. The potlatch will last a week, and in it, besides the drumming and the dancing and the feasting, the honored guests represent the deceased. There is a mystical transfer of identity from the deceased to the honored guests. In this way, the valuable qualities of the deceased, the hunting skills and other skills, are transferred to the living and kept in the village. It's a conservation of resources and a form of reincarnation. The honored guests undress their old clothes, which are burned, behind a screen and put on the new apparel and come forth, and there's much singing and dancing. And dancing around a pole too, the pole symbolism again, the tree of life. The memorial potlatch is a cleansing of the village from the haunting spirits. And as the honored guests depart with their elaborate dance regalia out of the door, they mustn't look back, because if they catch the eye of anybody, they'll take that person's spirit with them to the spirit world. And no crying children are allowed in the community hall at the memorial potlatch, because tears make the face sticky and the spirits of the children might stick to the departing spirits that are going out of that door with those honored guests. And you take food and you feed it into the fire and feed the spirits to appease those spirits and placate them so they won't get mad and take anybody with them out that door. Now, in the Northwest Coast here, we have a particularly interesting conclave of American Indians called the Northwest Coast Culture, and they were the richest of all American Indians because of the environment. They had salmon, deer, elk, bear, moose, whale, seal, all kinds of fur, that's the sea otter. And so they had lots of time left over for artwork, and that's where they got all their wood carving from. They had Douglas fir and cedar, and so they carved these enormous 40-foot canoes out of one tree and totem poles, and spent a lot of time dancing and carving. And you have to be rich to do that. You spend all day long looking for food, you haven't got much time left over for that. So they were the richest of American Indians. Now, all American Indians were what we call hunters and gatherers. They don't keep cattle, milk them and eat them for meat. And they don't plant seeds and grow gardens. They don't grow corn. There may have been other American Indian groups that did grow some corn. But up here, they were hunters and gatherers. Just about all American Indians, what we call hunters and gatherers, as opposed to pastoral societies that wander with reindeer or cattle, and agricultural societies that plant crops and harvest them. Now, when you get hunters and gatherers, they're generally nomadic because they have to go where the caribou migrate, or where the berry patch is, or where the fish are. They'll have a fish camp in winter, another camp in summer, another camp in spring. Hunters and gatherers are nomadic. Now, these are the only known hunters and gatherers in the whole world that lived in big villages and didn't move around. They lived 600 at a time in one village because of the richness of their resources. And they fought the Russians. They built a fort. The Russians built a fort at Sitka, but the Tlingit Indians wiped them out. So we have these rich hunters and gatherers that were settled in large villages of 600 people. Their artwork was centered around their religion. Their religion consisted of crests. Their crests were totemic. And the crests were large carved replicas of wolf heads, bear heads, killer whale with a big fin sticking up. The wolf always had big square ears and differs from the bear had big square ears and differed from the wolf because the wolf's tongue always had a long tongue hanging out on those totem poles. And then there's salmon and beaver and other totems. Now these crests were exhibited in public at elaborate potlatches. At the potlatches, there was validation of rank. The purpose of the potlatch was to display the crest, honor the crest, boast about it, outdo the other clans, and to validate rank of princes and other aristocrats. These Northwest Coast people, more than any other American Indians, were a very stratified society. They had the noblemen at the top, the aristocrats, then the commoners, then the slaves, then the prisoners of war. And these potlatches featured much fancy oratory about the origins of the tribe, dating all the way back to the mythology that says they came from the raven or the eagle. And these very aristocratic, powerful chiefs would vie with each other in conspicuous consumption at these potlatches. They would take 50 giant canoes and burn them. They would take 50 Chilkat blankets, now worth $30,000 apiece. Chilkat blankets are made of mountain goat wool and threaded cedar bark and woven in the round and used for dance blankets. They're called the dancing fringe in the Tlingit word. And burn them, or cut them up in small pieces. And they would take, each chief would take a certain number of slaves and kill them by rolling logs down the hill over them. And then the other one would kill more to show that he was more powerful. This took place in the late 1800s, when they became even richer than they had been before. They were rich because of the environment. They became even richer because of the fur trade. The white man moved in, they brought rifles. He would stand a rifle up like this and say, make a pile of beaver skins as high as the rifle, and you've got a trade. And the rifle was worth maybe, you know, $20, and the skins were worth thousands. But because of the fur trade, they became very rich, and their potlatches became really outrageous affairs of competitive, conspicuous consumption. Then it came to the point where the white man took over British Columbia and took over the Indian territories and established magistrates and commissioners and regional districts and banned the potlatch. Now, what the white man didn't understand was that potlatch was much more than meets the eye. The potlatch was a system of record keeping. The potlatch not only validated rank and praised the forefathers and retold the origin myths and kept them alive, but it recorded marriages, births, deaths, transfer of property, inheritance, installation of new chiefs, all of this was done at the potlatch. So banning the potlatch was the equivalent of somebody burning all of our libraries and all of our record system and destroying all our microfiches and computers and so on. So the whites came in and banned the potlatch. And it was banned from the early 1900s until the late 1920s. This was very ethnocentric. It was poor judgment. They not only did that, but they stole all of the carved artifacts. And the museums in Ottawa and Toronto are jam-packed with these beautiful masks and costumes and Chilkat blankets that the magistrates confiscated at potlatches that were held while the law was in effect, illegal potlatches. Today we try and practice cultural relativity. Cultural relativity means you don't judge other cultures by the laws of your own or by the standards of your own. A particular kind of dancing that to us might seem lewd and lascivious may have a totally different meaning to the people that are dancing it. Just because they have no clothes on doesn't mean to say that they're thinking lasciviously. It just may be a very hot climate and much more hygienic and healthy. See? So we made these cultural judgments that were very ethnocentric. We showed, in banning the potlatch and other ethnocentric acts, we showed disregard of the unique history of those people. When a people grow up over centuries in a certain region, they form certain customs that work for them. Not for Western Europe, but work for them on the equator or in the Arctic and so on. And we criticize the Eskimos because they used to let the old women go out in the snow and die on purpose, you see. But if those old women hadn't done that, the whole community would die. Or some baby would die. And the baby is the future. So they had their own way of working things out. The old lady was going to die anyway. So we show disregard then of the economic system of these people. They have a discrete economic system. And they have a discrete geographical location. For instance, timber right here that determines the kind of religion they have with all those totem poles. And the climate and the ecology of the area. That all determines what kind of a way of life, what kind of a worldview, what kind of subsistence, what kind of religion those people are going to have. All of these things add up to a very deep-rooted cognitive process amongst those people and a language to match. And when it's very hard to translate from the Indian into the English. It comes out very, very poetic and flowery, but loses a lot in the translation. Because they have certain ideas and ways of looking at things that we can't comprehend. I mean, old Eskimo said to me, now I'm going to cut this song in half. And he danced and he sang. I didn't understand what he meant. But in his mind, he was dividing a song in half. You see, it's a concept that we don't understand. Cutting a song in half. How can you cut a song in half? But he knew. It meant something to him. Likewise, when we go in and missionize, I mean, we tell the story of Jesus bringing Lazarus back from the dead. Well, the Indian shaman, he might bring, in the middle of winter, he might bring the frozen hunter, the frozen warrior back to life with his herbs and his magic and his incantations, you see. And he might even lie with maidens, like King David did, you see. But they won't think of Jesus as someone with a white robe and sandals. When you start talking that story to American Indians, they think of the shaman with his rattle and his big feathered headdress. That's Jesus, dancing and singing. Who else could bring the frozen some man back to life? So we have to beware of ethnocentrism and imposing our own cultural viewpoint that originated in Western Europe on American Indians, Eskimos, Africans, Amazon Basin, anywhere. Evangelism, Indians regard as gross disrespect. You see, they don't impose their religion on other people. And when we move in and say, your religion's wrong, but ours is right, and you must learn ours. And the missionaries come in and set up a school, and they say, if you speak Indian, we'll wash out your mouth with soap. You've got to learn a real language and cut out that gibberish. They regard that as gross disrespect of the customs. As a matter of fact, the first Indians to meet whites believed that the white people had come to them to learn manners. Okay. Well, we're going to keep it brief because it's so nice outside. Do we have any questions?
Well, I had a question. You talked about the totems, that a tribe has a totem. Is it the whole tribe has one totem, or an individual in the tribe will have a totem, another individual will have another totem?
Okay, now it depends on what we call a tribe. The Tlingit are a tribe of about 10,000, and they're divided into two exogamous halves, all of the ravens and all of the eagles. Mm-hmm. They're a matrilineal tribe too. You can only sing your mother's songs and inherit your mother's property and your mother's dance regalia and chilkat blankets. And the mother's brother teaches the children. So the whole tribe are the Tlingit, and the two exogamous halves each have the totem, eagle and raven. And then all of the raven have fish subtotems. For the subclans, the saying is raven on back, fish on head. So you have a raven costume and a fish helmet. And then the eagles will have wolf and bear and other animals under them. So there's a large number of totems.
Okay, yeah. And then an observation. You were talking about when they have a funeral or something and the things that they give to the dead to appease. Driving through British Columbia, there are several small cemeteries, you know, they must be family plots, and there will be food items, oranges, the
same
little
idea,
bottles of alcoholic beverages, all kinds of food on these graves that have been put there fairly recently.
Yeah.
Are they feeding the
Yeah, the
people?
Spirits have got a long journey and they need sustenance on the way.
Okay.
They've got to have their little backpack and
but
trail box
on
the way.
This isn't still appeasing anyone. This is
so
just
they don't,
food for
so
a
they
long
don't,
journey.
Yeah. If they don't make that journey, they come back to haunt the village. And they account for deaths and stolen children and so on. Yes. Very true. Yeah.
I'd just like for you to elaborate on this inclusiveness of the Indian religion. If I understood you correctly, the Indian, their religion is with them 24 hours a day.
Yes. Okay. Yes, they don't. And they don't have this very somber, sacred respect for their gods and their spirits, this tremendous remote awe, so that it's a distant, awesome father figure. They talk to their spirits and joke with them, rather like the old dad in Fiddler on the Roof. You know,
why are you doing this
to me, Dad? You know, and they give him a drink of beer, pour it on the ground. You see, yes, they are familiar spirits, and they're there all the time, part of life, part of everyday life. Yes.
You commented in the beginning about the migrations. Some writers talk a lot about the land bridge which might have been between Alaska and Siberia when the ice age is on.
Mm-hmm.
Is that probably a means of them making some of the migrations?
Yes, there were several migrations over many, many hundreds of centuries. Like 30,000 years ago, there'd be one wave, and 25,000 years ago, there'd be another wave, and 20,000 years ago, there'd be another wave. It didn't all just pour across in one land bridge. There were several ice ages and several migrations. And the Eskimos moved all the way to Greenland and moved back again. There is archaeological evidence that the cultures that moved all the way across eastward, one wandered back again in a circular fashion. And that may account for the fact the Athabascans moved down here and then moved back up again.
One writer I read, you know, we seem to be surprised that they might have got clear to the tip of South America, and yet, I guess if you calculate it mathematically by time, that's probably only 7 miles a generation.
Yeah, right.
So it isn't very
Yeah, you've got it. You got it. Oh, is there any more questions? You got one over here.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, Raven, you're going to marry an eagle. What are they then, the children from those eagles?
Whatever the mother was. Yeah. The mother is it's a matrilineal tribe, so whatever the mother is determines what they are. The father's an outsider. But then he acts as father to his sister's children. So he has a role. He has to teach. The father is actually a buddy or playmate of the children, but the uncle is the teacher and disciplinarian and teaches them all the rules and etiquette of the tribe.
Yeah, the parents are to love them, you know, just for love.
Yeah, right, just for love. Yeah, nurture. Yeah.
I've got a good friend who is a Sioux, and I've studied a lot of the Sioux religion and stuff, and she's always angry at me because I read all these books about Native American religions, and she says, that's through white man's eyes. She says, what happens is the white men would go in there and talk to the Native Americans who thought white men were being rude anyway for asking those silly questions or questions about things that they felt were sacred. So they'd tell them stupid things, stupid reasons. And a lot of these are recorded as history of the Native Americans' religions and stuff.
This was true of much of the early anthropology. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, they are more careful because they are American Indians who are professors with PhDs in these colleges in the Southwest. Mm-hmm. Who are perhaps doing their own research. So you have to, I mean, what you wrote in the 19th century, we knew they'd never see. What you write now is going to end up in the Santa Fe American Indian University Library. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've got a couple of questions. Maybe you will feel uncomfortable answering them, but one, I'll give them to you then. One, you know, you spoke of the Indians of the Northwest, and I was always under the impression, you know, the term Siwash, which basically, if I understood it correctly, was one of all these Indians were slovenly, they were not clean, and then the Plains Indian, in my mind, were the noble savage, you know, the buffalo hunters on horseback, the Sioux with their regalia and this sort of thing. And then the third question that you might be uncomfortable with, I'm real interested in your background. How did you come to latch on to Indians and gain this knowledge to show that? I think it's really
great. Indians that lived in Mosquito Territory traded seal oil from the Eskimos and smeared themselves with it in the summertime.
Oh, okay.
And so the oil smelled pretty strong. But that's just simply a bug repellent.
I see. Okay.
And the whites didn't know it. They just thought these people were dirty and greasy and smelled funny. But they they didn't want to be
eaten by the mosquitoes.
Right. Yeah. Scientists have been out in the tundra in Alaska and bared a certain part of the skin, like the forearm, till it was black with mosquitoes. And they calculated that within 2 hours, a naked man would have every drop of blood drained from his body in 2 hours. Now, as for my background, I took my degrees in California in 1968, went to Africa for 2 years, lived with a tribe, came back and started teaching about Africa at Western Washington State University, Bellingham, on the border here.
Oh, yes.
I'd been there 1 year when I got word from the Fairbanks campus that they were looking for an ethnomusicologist, and they had a very generous federal grant that would cover several years of research, a $60,000 National Science Foundation grant, to go up and study Eskimo music and dance because nobody had them. So I moved to that campus. And after that grant ran out, I got a $114,000 grant from the National Endowment from the Humanities to buy cameras and cinema equipment and tape recorders and hire helpers and translators and go and live out in these villages for several years. And I've been there 16 years now. Mm. And what most of what I know about American Indians, first of all, I took American Indian classes at Cal State Hayward and Cal State Fullerton, both of which I have master's degrees from. And then when I went to Alaska, we have these 10,000 Athabaskan and 10,000 Tlingit that I studied in detail by living amongst them.
Are you familiar with Dr. Erna Gunther from University
yes,
of Washington?
Yeah, there's some wonderful books about the Northwest Coast Indian,
right.
One of the most knowledgeable people
yeah,
on Northwest Coast and
okay.
Yeah. Well, I guess that kind of winds it up then. Yes?
We still haven't got to the point where we're not trying to force the Indian back into our own ways of living. It seems like we're trying to force them to
live for a number of years. They called America the melting pot, and the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, said assimilation was the answer to the Indian problem. We would assimilate them, we would educate them in white type schools, into English and so on, and assimilate them into the population. Since World War II, the Third World has become powerful. Black nations have emerged in Africa. There is American Indianism, nativism, rebellion. Black civil rights, Congress of Racial Equality. So there's gradually emerged an awareness of cultural rights, that it's okay to be an Indian or okay to be a black. And how are you going to assimilate a black person anyway? I mean, color-wise. They're always going to be black, you see. So now the thrust word is biculturality. Biculturality. You can go and talk to your Indian grandma, and you can wear your Indian costume and do your dances and songs, and then you can go and work at the bank in Los Angeles, and you have this bicultural aspect to you, where you may have grown up an Indian, but you can also deal with and handle. You are also an American. Perhaps first of all, you're an American. You see, an Eskimo perhaps is first of all an American. In World War II, they were our lookouts and our watchmen and our National Guards there in Alaska on the coast. So the tendency in the BIA moved from assimilation to one of biculturality, and we recognize that cultural roots and identity are very important. You have a young lad who's grown up an Eskimo with an Eskimo childhood, full of grandma's stories and the Eskimo language and hunting, wanting to learn hunting skills. And then he's taken away and sent to a white high school some other place with American Indians and other people. And he comes back. He doesn't know how to build a skin boat. He doesn't know how to catch a whale. He doesn't know how to keep a trap line. But there's no jobs in that village. All he's fit for is to go and live as a second-class citizen in Los Angeles or Seattle. So now we're beginning to recognize that problem. We're building high schools in the villages so they don't have to go away from home. And we're recognizing the fact that a person with a native childhood and a second-class white adulthood is a person that's going to spend the rest of their life in the twilight zone, isn't really a fully functioning member of society, and doesn't do the country any good. We've got to find another answer to the problem. It's not easy. It's not an easy answer to the problem.
How are we searching for that answer now?
Well, at our university of 4,000 students, 600 of them are native. And there's one person in five is a native in Alaska. One person in five. There's half a million people in Alaska, and there's 100,000 of them are native. Athabaskan, Tlingit, or Inupiaq Eskimo, or Yupik Eskimo. And they come to the university, and they're becoming lawyers and business managers, and we have them on university faculty, and they are magistrates and judges, and state troopers, so they're entering the mainstream of Alaska society, the Eskimos, Athabaskan, and the Tlingit, particularly the Tlingit. The Tlingit, being an aristocratic society, had an education system in place, so they more readily accepted the idea of formal education and bureaucracy. And for many decades, all of the native organizations in Alaska, the Alaska Native Brotherhood and so on, were dominated by Tlingits. It doesn't matter if it was an Eskimo organization, Athabaskan organization. It had a Tlingit president, a Tlingit lawyer, a Tlingit treasurer. The Tlingits became the bureaucrats, and this was somewhat resented by the other tribes, but it's because of the nature of their culture. They had a very aristocratic, educative-oriented society, whereas the Athabaskans and the Eskimos were very every man for himself, egalitarian. a kind of a society without formal rigidity. The Thinkists are extremely formal, very rigid, much oratory, many, many rules for life, a lot of pride, great deal of pride, very special rules about how you relate to this uncle and this grandpa and so on.
But they have a lot of pride, I believe, too. It wasn't too long ago that they were from Iowa, and in Tama County, it has a Meskwaki tribe of Indians, and they built houses for the Indians because they lived in their tents there. Well, the Indians put their horses in their houses, and then they still built the tents out in front.
Yeah.
They're used to that way of living, and they couldn't change it.
Well, it's also more functional, too. They can lift up the tent and go. You know, and that going is the important part of their life. And you don't need too much maintenance for a tent. Who's going to replace those gutters and drain pipes and buy the heating oil? And you know, it doesn't make any sense. We got all of our coastal Eskimos on oil. You see, we took away their seal oil and their seal oil lamp and all their traditional customs. Now we have to bring in boats and planes and bring all of that expensive oil in at $100 for a 50-gallon drum. Things are very, very expensive around here. A gallon of milk, $5 or more, because it's all flown in.
We were in Fairbanks last summer.
Good. Okay, so was I.
Interesting.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.